Text this morning is Genesis chapter 22, beginning with verse 1, and going through verse 19. Genesis chapter 22. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, Here am I. He said, Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, My father. And he said, Here am I, my son. He said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went both of them together. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. He said, Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, The Lord Will Provide, as it is said to this day, On the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. This is the word of God. Now, I don't know how that story strikes you, but many Americans, upon hearing that story for the first time, would reject this picture of God. They would say, what kind of God would ask somebody to do what God asked Abraham to do there? What kind of God would put somebody through that? But of course, their problem is not with God. Their problem is with their picture of God. Because many people worship an imaginary God. In fact, many people who are in church most every Sunday do not know the God of the Bible. And if you are inclined to disagree with me, that's okay, but I just beg your indulgence for a minute because I want to show you something, some evidence to back up what I'm saying. Because somebody did a recent study of what Americans believe, actually American teenagers in particular, and what they found is very sobering. authors Christian Smith and Melinda Denton recently published a book entitled Soul Searching: The Religious and Spiritual Life of American Teenagers. They interviewed 3,000 teenagers to find out what they believe. This is how they summed up their findings. This is what American teenagers believe. A God exists who created and ordered the world and watches over human life on earth. So far, so good. God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. Okay. The central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life, except when God is needed to resolve a problem. And good people go to heaven when they die. Now, even the authors, who make no personal claim to Christian faith, recognize how far this is from biblical Christianity. You notice there's nothing there about sin, about man's separation from God, about repentance, about judgment, about salvation, about Christ. A belief system like this is called deism. Which, yes, it's not atheism. I believe in God. It's just that God really isn't active in the world. He's not really involved in anybody's life. And here's the scary part. The authors found that many of these young deists who believe this are active in their churches, often in so-called evangelical churches where supposedly the Bible is being taught, and yet this is what they believe. Now, that leaves only three possible explanations for why teens would believe this way, and none of them are encouraging. Maybe, first of all, they don't really comprehend what their church is teaching, or maybe they do understand it and they just choose not to believe it, or maybe they're actually accurately describing what they're hearing in church. And another thing here, the authors believe that it's not just teenagers who believe this way. That was their study, but they came to the conclusion that the teenagers really represent American society as a whole. They call this belief moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, that's a mouthful, but it unpacks very simply. Okay, moralistic, because it centers on behavior rather than grace. If you're good enough, then you get to go to heaven. That's moralism. Okay? Therapeutic, because my personal happiness is the main thing. God is my heavenly therapist. He's there to cheer me up when I'm down. That's what he's there for. And again, deism, because God exists, but he's largely irrelevant to daily life. Now, this describes the beliefs of many adults, too. And I'm afraid it describes what is taught in many supposedly evangelical churches. In fact, more than one observer has suggested that moralistic therapeutic deism, maybe we could call it MTD for short, is really the dominant religion in America today. That many so-called evangelical churches are teaching these beliefs, if not expressly, then implicitly in the messages that they send from week to week. Well, Abraham in Genesis chapter 22 is a powerful correction of this belief system, MTD. He's the perfect picture of the human condition, desperate and helpless before the Creator, the only one who can save him. He stands before the God who doesn't make deals with humans, who does not come to us on our terms. Here's another way to put it. You can't manage God. That's the title of this message. The unmanageable God. You can't manage God. You may have learned to manage people. You may have learned to manage, for example, a difficult spouse or a pesky neighbor or a stubborn child or a mean teacher. You know you've learned what to say and what not to say to avoid problems and to get what you want from this other broken human. You can manage people, but you cannot manage God. He is totally, utterly unmanageable. We come to God only on His terms. And His terms may terrify us. What will you do when God calls you into the unknown, into loss, into sorrow, into pain or struggle or grief? What will you do when He demands of you the impossible? Well, my burden today is to show you that the God of the Bible is not some kind of grandfather sitting on a heavenly rocking chair, just waiting for you to call on Him, someone that you manage and push Him off to a corner of your life until you need something and then beckon Him. No, but that rather you stand before God as Abraham does. God is the one who is in control. God is the one who sets the demands on your life, and they are demands that are impossible and non-negotiable. Impossible, non-negotiable demands that can be met in only one way. That's what Abraham discovered. May we also discover that this morning. Now today, we come to the end of Abraham's story that we've been on for some weeks now, ever since Genesis chapter 12. One of the most powerful human accounts in the Bible. One of the primary stories of relationship between God and a man. Today, God speaks to Abraham for the 35th and last time. And the writer actually does something in a literary way that's very compelling to show us this is the end, pay attention. He uses a little phrase at the beginning that he uses again here. You will remember in Genesis chapter 12, we read that God told Abraham to go out to a place that I will show you. And the Hebrew, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but it's something like lekka, go out to this place. And he uses that again here in verse 2. Take your son and go out to the place of which I will show you. Lekka. That's the only two times in the entire Hebrew Bible that these phrases are used. Lekka at the beginning, lekka at the end. This is the end. This is the sort of bookend of Abraham's story. Now remember that Genesis was originally written for the children of Israel, probably when they were about to enter the promised land. They were the original readers and hearers of this story. And it's not hard to see what the author is doing for the children of Israel when you think about it. You will remember the Israelites, and even Jesus in the New Testament, he refers over and over to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These are the patriarchs of the Jewish people, their forefathers, their ancestors. And for the first half of this story, the survival of ancestor Isaac is kind of up for grabs. Now, obviously, they know he survived, but what they learn here is how close he came to dying before he ever had children. And if that had happened, of course, they would never have been born. But God's mercy prevails. Isaac is saved when God stops Abraham and provides a lamb in his place. God provides, Isaac is saved, and the children of Israel have a new reason to give praise and marvel at the mercy of God. Now, notice this account opens with a very important footnote. After these things, God tested Abraham. Why is that important? Here's why it's very important. It removes any possible misunderstanding that God actually was going to require human sacrifice. There is such a thing, of course, in the history of the world. Gods who require human sacrifice. That is not the God of the Bible. That is not where God was going. He has no intention that Abraham should actually murder his son. This is God testing for a different purpose. Someone has said that Satan tempts us to destroy us, but God tests us to strengthen us. So the writer assures us, this is a test, he assures us, but Abraham doesn't know that. And that's equally important to understand, because as far as Abraham knows, God has just made an unspeakable demand of him, and there's no reason to think that he's not serious. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Now, if you're Abraham and you've just heard that, you have to be in shock for a couple of reasons. First, just the obvious horror of what he's just heard, what God has asked him to do. But there's also another reason for shock. It has to be very confusing to this man. Think for a minute about all that he's been through for 25 years on this matter of promised offspring. It's more than 25 years. But when he was 75 years old, God told him, you're going to have offspring, as many offspring as the stars in the heavens and the sand on the seashore. I'm going to make of you a great nation. He says that in 12. And then he repeats it a few years later. He says, I will make, in 13 verse 16, I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring can also be counted. Then when Abraham is about 80, he reminds God, you know, I still don't have any kids, God. He says in 15 verse 2, what will you give me, for I continue childless? Did you forget, God? Then when he's 85, Hagar conceives his child. But then he allows Sarai to drive Hagar away. She goes into the wilderness. What's going to become of his offspring now? But then she comes back. I mean to tell you, it's been a 25-year roller coaster. But then, in chapter 17, God really drops a bomb. Abraham figures, okay, finally, I've got this son Ishmael, you know, and now we can get on to this offspring thing. And then God says to him, no. No, Sarah, your wife, is going to have a son, Isaac. And he can't process that. He says, God, if only Ishmael might live before you. Remember? Don't put me through all of this again. And finally, at age 100, 25 years after God first gave the promise, Isaac arrives. And now, maybe another 15 or 16 years later, he says, take this son to a mountain and offer him there as a burnt offering. Now, I think Abraham is having a hard time managing God, I would say. You know, when you read this story carefully, you notice something unusual, and that is the level of detail. It's a very, very high level of detail. Starting in verse 3, the author takes us into Abraham's world. Getting up early, saddling the donkey, finding a couple of servants, cutting the wood, setting off on the journey. Later he has the servants, you stay here. He takes the wood and puts it on Isaac. He's got the knife, he's got the fire. They start off again. And then later he builds the altar, he lays the wood in order, he binds Isaac, he reaches out his hand, he picks up the knife. This is a very unusual level of detail. Those details are not critical to the big picture of this story here. Very few Bible stories have that much detail in them. I believe what the writer is doing is slowing down the pace. So we are walking along beside Abraham and feeling what he's feeling. We're absorbing this horror, this dread in his heart. Think about his experience. He's walking 3 days toward this unspeakable disobedience. The journey takes 3 days because it's about 50 miles from Beersheba to Mount Moriah. And we're really not told anything about his thoughts during these days. Just silence. We're left to imagine what he's thinking, the dread, the terror, the dark, stomach-churning fear. And then we come to another fascinating pattern in this story. God tells Abram, as I mentioned, Abraham, in verse 2, take your son to the place I will tell you. And then three more times, he refers to that awful destination. In verse 3, towards the end, he says he arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Verse 4, on the third day he lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Verse 9, when they came to the place of which God had told him. It's that dreadful spot where the unthinkable will happen. The place, the place, the place. It remains nameless, but only for now. And we'll come back to that and see in a minute what that means. But once they get there, then the action comes in very high drama. Look at verse 9. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here am I. And he must have dropped the knife like that. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Now I know. Now I know. Now that's an interesting thing for God to say. He didn't know before. God didn't learn anything here, folks. What God is saying, I believe, is that now I know from watching what I already knew as the omniscient God, the God who knows everything, real or imaginary, past, present, and future. Now it was demonstrated to him that Abraham feared God. And what evidence is there that Abraham fears God? Because he says, you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Whoa. Abraham feared God. Abraham was prepared to obey even this, and God commended him. Another way to say that, God expected Abraham to obey this impossible demand. And remember, Abraham didn't know this was a test. As far as Abraham knew, Isaac was about to die at Abraham's hand. This doesn't sound very therapeutic to me. This doesn't sound much like a sort of grandfather God waiting for me to ask him to bless me. This is God who sent Abraham on this awful journey. Abraham knew it was God who had sent him to this place and to this deed. He knew that his only choice was either to obey God or reject God, who was his only source of life and hope. Does this sound to you like the God of moralistic, therapeutic deism? The God who wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other? The God who wants you to be happy and feel good about yourself? The God who doesn't need to be particularly involved in your life except when you need him to resolve a problem? Abraham feared God. I think the God that the moralistic, therapeutic deist worships doesn't know is a different God. I'll put it this way, because the MTD guy doesn't fear God. In that system, God is to be managed, not feared. But Abraham is not a deist. He feared God and obeyed God, and because he did, the nation of Israel is here. Think about that. God's redemptive plan for the world was resting on Abraham's obedience. Now, if Abraham had failed, God would have found a different plan. God's purposes are never thwarted. They're never reversed. So God would have achieved it, but we wouldn't be reading about this one. We wouldn't be reading about Abraham. We would have never heard of Abraham, except that he feared and obeyed God. Now let's quickly cut to the end of the story. Abraham finds the ram that God had provided. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Then, remember what I said about this nameless place? He's going to that place. He's seeing that place from afar. And it's just an awful place. Something that you don't want him to think about, much less name it. But then he names it. Did you see that in verse 14? So Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide. Now once again, in the Hebrew it would sound something like Yahweh, which is the name of the covenant name of God, Yireh, will provide. Yahweh Yireh became the name of that place, and it says, as it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided. I love to think of generations of Hebrew children asking their father, Dad, how did this place ever get to be called Yahweh Yireh anyway? Well, son, let me tell you the story as it is known to this day. And then one more time, God repeats the promise of blessing to Abraham and through him to the world. And this time he adds a phrase that is seen only here in the Bible. I swear by myself. That's the only place this shows up. Verse 15, the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your only son, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. And with these last words of God to Abraham, we come to the closing bookend. It started by God promising to bless Abraham and through him to bless all the nations of the earth, and it ends with the same promise. Now, there's so much in this story for us. There's so many themes here. We could spend several Sundays talking about things like faith, like obedience, maybe ethics. How does God lead us? Family. Many things, but let's just consider the faith of Abraham, for example. Is there a lesson in faith here? Absolutely. Radical faith. And more than one New Testament writer has picked up this theme. Here's one example in the chapter that Tom read for us earlier. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead. How else is God fulfill his promise? Okay, I guess he's going to raise my son from the dead after I kill him, because he promised. From which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. Wow, to have the faith of Abraham. May you and I grow in that direction every day. The same chapter says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Are you learning new lessons about faith? Are you trusting God today for your unknown future? May we all grow in this area of faith. Faith is what God holds us responsible for. God expects us to believe Him. But it occurs to me to ask this question. Is there anything else here? Is there anything maybe deeper or higher or bigger than just trust in God? And I don't mean to say by that trusting in God is a small thing. But here's where I'm going. We must never lose sight of the bigger truth than faith, and that is the object of our faith. You know, a lot of people act as if faith itself is the point. I'm a person of faith. Have you ever heard anybody say that? I'm a person of faith. And I think, well, good for you, but of course, so is him and her. And everybody is a person of faith. To be human is to believe in something. Because I think somehow to be human is to recognize I'm not complete. There's something missing. And so you put your faith in something. You attach your hopes and dreams to something. You believe in something. You worship something. And if it's not the God of the Bible, it's any of a number of things. Some false god of self. I can do it. Of power. of money, of pleasure, of family, of achievement, or any one of the millions of so-called gods of false religions. So faith itself is never the point, not detached from the biblical object of faith. You see, the main point in this story is not Abraham and his faith, but the one in whom Abraham believed. The one who in his providence had already gone before Abraham to provide the ram, the one who intervened in the story, the one who blessed the world through Abraham. And by the way, how does God promise to bless the world through Abraham? What does it say in verse 18? In your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. He's going to bless the world through Abraham's offspring. What does that mean? To answer that question, we need to pursue the rest of the story, and we need to bring some threads together of substitution and sacrificial lambs and God's providence and Abraham's offspring. So let's see if we can weave these threads together in a story. Isaac is saved here at Mount Moriah because of a substitute. This story has the first explicit reference in the Bible to what will be, you could almost say, is the main theme of the Bible. A substitutionary death. Look at verse 13. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. A burnt offering instead of his son. Because of that substitute, Isaac lives and eventually has a son of his own, Jacob, who has 12 sons who become the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel, God's chosen people, Abraham's offspring. And then in the closing chapters of Genesis, God in his providence rescues them because they're in a famine in Canaan and they're going to perish. God prearranges all of this and he takes them down to Egypt where they are saved from the famine, but they become slaves and they spend 400 years there until God delivers them. And on their last night in Egypt, God sends the 10th plague. Do you remember what it was? And it's okay to talk in this little church. What was the 10th plague? Okay. I heard the firstborn, and that's right. The angel of death would come over the land of Egypt and kill the firstborn son in every family. But God provided a way for his people, an escape from this. He told them, kill a lamb and take some of the blood and put it on the side post and the top of your door. And when the angel of death comes, he'll see the lamb and he will accept the lamb in place of your son and he will pass over your house. God gave them those instructions, and then he said, and every year you are to remember this night when God set you free from Egypt, from slavery, and you are to kill a Passover lamb in remembrance of this night. And the feast of the Passover became one of the highest days in the Jewish calendar. Even in New Testament times, every year at Passover, thousands of Jewish pilgrims would come to Jerusalem to the temple and celebrate the Passover. They would sacrifice the Passover lambs there at the temple on Mount Zion. Mount Zion. But it used to be called something different. Because where they offered those lambs, where they sacrificed those lambs, was on Mount Zion, but it used to have a different name. It used to be called Mount Moriah. It was the same hill where Abraham bound Isaac and laid him on the altar, and God provided that original substitutionary lamb. The same hill. You can visit Moriah today. It's not called that anymore, and it doesn't look different. I mean, it looks different, but it's the same mountain. It looks like this. And this is where the Passover was celebrated for generations. This is where Abraham offered Isaac on the altar. And something else happened here too. Something that was pictured in the ram that Abraham found and killed in place of his son Isaac, and in the same place where all these Passover lambs were killed, another male lamb died there in the place of someone else. He died there in my place. He died there in your place. In the same spot where this Genesis 22 story happened, a final substitution was made. One more Passover lamb was slain. He even died during the feast of the Passover. Lambs bleeding, sacrificial lambs bleeding as he hung on the cross. Matthew writes, after 2 days, Jesus said, the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. John writes, now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, that's Pilate, behold your king. They cried out, away with him. Crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. So he delivered them over to be crucified. So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus, and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of a skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him. John the Baptist had said of him, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. The Passover Lamb of God died for you. Abraham did not have to give up his son, but that's exactly what God did. Isaac was rescued, but for Jesus there was no rescue because he died for you. That's what God meant when he said, in your offspring, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And this story on Mount Moriah, generations earlier, was there to picture what God would do centuries later at Calvary. Here, God puts Abraham in a very hard spot, but it's not because God is cruel or capricious. He's acting deliberately, as he always does. He never does anything by accident. His purposes are always just. If he calls you into trouble or struggle or pain, as he did Abraham, it's in those moments that we discover, as Abraham did, how unmanageable God is, and how merciful and loving he is. It's okay that God is unmanageable, because only he knows all things. Only God can provide what you need. And if you understand this truth, you also understand that life in God is not a matter of keeping some rules so that he has to do what you want, and so that you get to go to heaven because you were so good. He doesn't do that. He's not managed like that. He doesn't make deals with anyone. He is God. And he can be trusted with your life no matter what he calls you into. He's unmanageable, but love undergirds his every act toward you. He never calls you into anything but with overwhelming, if sometimes invisible, love. He's big enough, he's loving enough to be trusted with your life. God demanded from Abraham what only God could supply. God demands from you what only he himself can provide. Now you can listen to that and say, well, that's not fair, God, for you to demand something that I can't do. I'm not going to play by those rules. Or you can say, whoa, you mean your life, your power is available to me? Your salvation is available to me, and fall at his feet and worship at the foot of his cross to confess your helplessness and to draw on the salvation that only he can provide. This is the only way that his impossible demands can be met, because the unmanageable God is always worthy of your trust.